You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello all, Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious Podcast here. Each week I interview an author or historian about a historical true crime, tragedy, or disaster. Subject matter ranges from gunslingers to Gilded Age murder to gangsters to fires to pirates to wild prison breaks. My guests bring their incredible knowledge directly to you. Please subscribe to Most Notorious on your favorite podcast app. Cheers, and have a safe tomorrow.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ plus royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
All right, quiet on the set.
Camera speed.
Sound production, take one.
Action!
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era. Hear fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine, who quite literally lives just beneath the Hollywood sign, and actress-writer Nan McNamara. Now your hosts, Steve and Nan.
You know that old thing when you were a kid about being afraid of what's under the bed?
Yes.
Well, in preparation for this episode, I've been a little afraid of what's under my bed.
What is under your bed?
Which is a box of old diaries.
Ooh.
From, oh my gosh.
Lindsay, I'm with you. Let's read the diaries.
You know what? I think it's probably just a list of...
But what age, though? When did they start?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think it goes all the way back to when I was a teenager.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, boxes. So it mainly chronicles, like Bridget Jones's diary, I feel fat today. Oh. I need to go and lose some...
Earth-shattering confessions.
Good. Yes, or... Why isn't that boy like me or whatever? So a little embarrassing. I think I need to burn them.
I used to journal because guys call it journaling.
Yes, well, now I do kind of keep a journal, but it's more events.
Yes,
you know,
I would journal and I had this ritual that every New Year's Eve, I would sit down with my journal, I would read it, and then I'd burn it.
Oh, my gosh. So you don't have any
journals? I have nothing. I'm clean.
Journals.
I'm clean, baby.
You're clean. Okay. Well, I might have to do that tonight after we do this episode.
Yeah. Well, this episode is about how diaries can get you in a lot of trouble.
And, of course, we're talking about Mary Astor and the Purple Diaries.
Yes.
And most people know Mary Astor from appearing in classics like The Maltese Falcon. She won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for The Great Lie in 1941. Overall, her career spans from silent films into talkies. Many people did not make that transition.
Yes.
She made it beautifully. And she was in over 100 films.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, she's in The Hurricane, Red Dust, The Prisoner of Zenda, The Palm Beach Story. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of great films she was in. I think a great way to encapsulate the public and private Mary Astor would be to look back on a time in 1948 when she was spending her mornings on the MGM backlot filming this dark, gritty film noir called Act of Violence.
Okay.
Where she's playing this tough-talking prostitute who helps Van Heflin. And in the afternoon, she crosses the lot at MGM, she puts on Victorian garb, and she plays Marmee, the beloved mother figure to June Allison, Elizabeth Taylor, Janet Leigh, and Margaret O'Brien in the beloved classic Little Women.
Wow.
It was, you know, it was part ladylike Madonna, part whore.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, at least
she'd probably say that too.
Yeah, and that's probably what the public came to think back in 1936 when she was involved in one of the most salacious sex scandals of the era. And we're going to talk about it.
So I think before we get into the details of the actual scandal, there's a big setup here.
Oh, yeah.
And we've talked about this before with parents, right? Now, we chatted. I always say, if you're still complaining about what your parents did to you over 40, you need to get some therapy. But legitimately,
what
Mary Astor's parents did to her, and her name is not No. Mary Astor.
Mary Astor in her autobiography talks about the product of Mary Astor
yes.
that was created and formed and provided livelihood to many, many people. And I think that's part of the problem as well. She was born Lucille Langhanke in Quincy, Illinois on May 3rd, 1906. Her father, Otto, and her mother, Helen, were teachers. He was a German immigrant and she was a wannabe actress.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very strict. They were very unloving, very unaffectionate. She didn't have a lot of love and warmth in her early years. When she was 12 years old, I mean, she grew into this beautiful young girl. And so she sent a photo into a beauty pageant or a beauty contest, which was sponsored by Motion Picture Magazine, and she became a finalist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, her father, Otto, he realized what a commodity he had in this beautiful young daughter of his.
Right.
And so she entered the next year, the same contest. She became a finalist again. Otto, who's now this strong-willed, dominating force in her life, who's basically taken over her life, decides Mary's going to be a star and we're going to make this happen. So he moves the family first to Chicago, then to New York, so that we could pursue Otto's dream, not Mary's, of making Mary a star.
So she has her photograph taken by a very famous photographer at the time, Charles Albin.
Yes.
And those photos are seen by a studio.
Yes. There's an executive at Lasky Famous Players who got the photographs and called her in for a screen test. And I find this fascinating.
I do too.
The person who directed the screen test was none other than the motion picture star Lillian Gish.
Yes.
Who had an interest in directing. So they let her direct these screen tests with these young girls. Well, Lillian Gish thought Mary Astor was phenomenal. Mm. She was so impressed with her beauty, her talent, her charisma. She really took the young actress under her wing. And so they signed her to a traditional 6-month contract. Lillian Gish and Jesse Lasky and Walter Wanger, who we've talked about before,
yeah.
they renamed her Mary Astor. So that's when she actually became Mary Astor officially.
And she's still a teenager in these silent films.
Yeah, she's 13, 14 years old.
And beautiful.
Yeah, and so she makes one appearance in a Lasky Famous Player film, and then her contract expires, and they decide not to renew it. Well, Lillian Gish is not having this, so she takes Mary across the street to D.W. Griffith,
oh.
and she arranges a screen test for Griffith. Well, Griffith really liked Mary. However, during the screen test, Griffith got a look at Otto, her father, on the sidelines, and he later told Lillian, "The man's a walking cash register. I could never mold this child into an actress with him on my neck all the time."
Oh, boy.
So he didn't sign her.
And was he right about that?
Oh, he was. He saw the writing on the wall with controlling Otto.
Yes.
And he probably dodged a bullet having to deal with this stage parent.
Right.
She ended up, though, working independently in movies. She made her first film when she was only 14 years old.
Wow.
She made a couple more films. And then in 1923, her family, like most of the film business, migrated to Hollywood.
And there's someone that sees a photograph of her that is going to be quite pivotal for the future of her career.
Yes.
John Barrymore sees her in a photograph and immediately decides that he wants her cast in a film called Beau Brummel that he was doing at Warner Brothers. So it's so creepy. She well, is yeah. 17. He is 40, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
I think he's 40. And he understands, I think, the situation with the parents.
Yes. He made her do a screen test.
Mm-hmm.
And during the screen test, he whispers in her ear.
I
don't know if I can say this. You know, I may censor a little bit. But he basically says to Mary, "You are so damned beautiful, you make me feel faint." I mean, this is the 40-year-old man to a 17-year-old girl.
And just as a side note, remember, John Barrymore is huge.
Oh.
He is considered the finest actor of his generation.
Biggest star in Hollywood at the time.
And not a bad-looking guy.
No,
so,
not at all.
So he somehow convinces the parents that he should give their daughter acting lessons.
Yes.
But in a very creepy move, he decides, I'm going to give the acting lessons at first at their house so that they feel safe and comfortable with me. I mean, it's very predatory.
Very.
And that happens, and they do get comfortable. And then he says, you know what? I think Mary would do much better. She's very self-conscious around you. I think she would do much better if we did acting lessons apart from you all. So he takes her to his private hotel, I guess. Is it a hotel?
And Otto and Helen agreed to it.
And they agree. And they say, sure. And so they go to do their private acting lessons, which of course turn out to be something.
Yeah, a torrid love affair begins. And I think because Mary didn't get a lot of love and affection from her parents,
yes,
she learned to equate sex with emotional love. I think she's even said that in her autobiography.
Yes.
Since she never learned what true love was from the point of a child, she thought, if a man is attracted to me and wants me sexually, that's emotional love.
Yes.
And she sought that out. She needed that. I mean, she was just void of that.
And yet, at the same time, she could not break free from her parents.
No.
And that comes up, you know, a little bit later. But she really had a hard time being an independent person until much later in her life.
Barrymore, he made her read books. He made her read poetry. He made her study art and music and drama. You know, he taught her to be an independent thinker, which I think began her road to freedom from her parents, but not quite
agreed
yet. When he finally divorced his wife, he asked Mary to marry him, but she still could not break away from the control of her father. And she said, not yet. Give me time.
Right.
Well, he got tired of waiting. And then his eyes wandered over to another starlet, Dolores Costello. And that was it. You know, it was over.
So ultimately, the demise of that relationship was because she couldn't break free from her parents.
And I think that really bothered Mary Astor.
I think it
was a big regret in her life that she missed out on this wonderful man, even though I don't know how appropriate it is, 1740.
I know. But, it's kind of weird to talk about it. But
she did feel badly that her inability to break free of the bondage of her family prevented her from maybe finding the love of her life.
Exactly. And I think essentially when that builds up inside her, she kind of runs away from home.
Her career really takes off after that. She becomes a major, major movie star.
Yes. She's making a lot of money.
She's making $5,000 a month, but more importantly, she is now the main and only breadwinner for the family because Otto has decided he is going to manage all her affairs.
Right.
Well, what Otto does is he basically keeps her captive in the mansion that she bought for the family, which actually is about two blocks from my house. It's called Moorcrest. It's an amazing
Moorish house
that was built by the, you know, the people that built the Crotona colony, which is we've gotten into before in the podcast. But he also gives her an allowance of $5 a week.
Well, that's just so generous of him, isn't it?
Otto was a giver.
He was a giver. Yeah. So he's in complete control.
She's totally in control.
She's working her butt off, pardon my expression.
Well, and the family lived lavishly.
Oh my gosh, they lived so lavishly.
Chauffeur and limo and servants and this big mansion, which Andy Samberg now owns that mansion.
Yeah.
It's still there.
And she was not actually given control of her own salary until she was 26. And her parents sued their own daughter for financial support.
Long before the Jackie Coogan law.
Yes,
so,
yes.
See, Jackie did a good thing.
So Mary Astor finally gets control of her life, internally at least. And she decides, I have got to get the heck out of here.
I've had enough.
And she does it in one of the most dramatic, I mean, I had to reread it in multiple sources to make sure that it was true. Because I was like, no, that didn't really happen. She takes a sash or like a blanket or something and ties it to herself and the tree and swings out of her balcony and escapes.
She literally ran away from home at 21.
At 21.
You know, she checked into a hotel. And she basically told the parents, that's it. I am done with this. You can't control me anymore. Well, her parents, of course, they became terrified because the cash cow was out of the house.
And she puts them on an allowance.
Yeah, well, she did. They made an agreement. We'll reconcile, but things are going to be a lot different. And exactly. She put them on an allowance, and she took control of her life.
Yeah.
And she also learned to have fun.
Yes.
I mean, she kind of went wild, basically.
She kind of went wild. I mean, just to give some perspective, she is quoted as saying, from 1920 to 1930, I gave my father $461,000 while Mary kept only $24,000.
Yeah.
That's That's amazing. Crazy. So she goes wild.
Yeah, this new freedom. I mean, she starts smoking and drinking and dancing, and she bobs her hair, and she becomes a very modern girl in Hollywood. She has a ball. She moves into her own apartment on Whitley Avenue in Hollywood, which is still another great old building that's still there. And during this time, she becomes briefly engaged to an AD. She dates a writer, John Mock Saunders. I mean, she is living her best life.
She is.
And then she meets the guy that would change everything.
Ken Hawks.
Yes.
She meets Ken Hawks, who is actually the brother of Howard Hawks. And in a way, from everything I've read about him, he was kind of the best of Barrymore in that he was also very sophisticated. And
he was a Yale graduate.
Exactly. Yeah. Well-read. Yeah. But he didn't have the age difference or the creepy factor.
And he was good-looking. He was very good-looking.
He was very good-looking and connected to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And they marry.
They spoke the same language.
They did.
Yeah, and I think they were very happy. I think Mary finally was starting to learn what it was like to feel loved and to feel safe and secure. And I think that changed her a great deal.
Right.
They married in 1928. Hawks had made a fortune in the stock market. But then the 29 crash, he lost everything. So they were kind of starting over as a newlywed couple.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he was getting into producing and directing. She was still making movies, making money. So they were okay, but they didn't have the wealth that he once had.
And I'm not sure that they had the physical part of the relationship that she longed for.
No.
Yeah.
Actually, she writes about that in her autobiography that maybe a little disappointed.
But still, it seems like...
Well, I guess after John Barrymore.
Right? There's probably a hard comparison there.
Yeah.
So tragedy, though, strikes.
Oh, this is so... She's finally happy. And it's like Robert Walker. You're finally happy and then boom.
Yeah. At 23, her husband, Ken Hawks, is flying in an airplane to create a sequence for a film called Such Men Are Dangerous.
Yeah, like an aerial sequence or shooting.
Yeah. And the plane connects inadvertently with another plane, and everyone is killed.
Just almost mid-air collision type thing. Ugh.
And it really affects her.
Oh, it just...
As it, of course,
it
would.
It just devastated her.
Yeah.
You know, she couldn't live alone. She moved in with...
Florence Eldridge.
Florence Eldridge and her husband, Frederick March, who were really dear friends of hers. I mean, she was a mess. The heartbreak affected her for a long time. She finally starts to heal a little bit. She starts dating again, and she dates this actor named Lee Tracy, who apparently was a raging alcoholic. And, you know, he liked to have a good time. So one night he drank too much and a doctor was called.
Uh-huh.
And the doctor was Dr. Franklin Thorpe. And Mary was immediately drawn to this guy. You know, he was good looking. He was intelligent. He listened to her problems. He was sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just had all these great social graces. And he wasn't in her field. She liked the fact that he wasn't part of Hollywood. He had a whole different world of his own.
Although he was pretty excited by her fame and money.
Well, yes. Dr. Thorpe, he ended up treating her because she went to him later because she had these spotches on her stomach, and it ended up being TB, which in those days, TB was like what AIDS was in the 80s.
Yes.
If you had TB, you were done. You were ostracized and you're, you know, it could have
But it was just
career.
The beginnings of it. So.
Yeah, he caught it early and he was able to treat it, but he had to quarantine her for a couple of months where the only person she saw was him and a maid.
Yes.
And of course, they fell in love during these 2 months of quarantine. And,
of course. And they ended up getting married.
And I think he put forth the best of him during the courtship.
Oh, yes.
But then
we've all dated people like that, right?
We've all dated people like that. And then once they're married, everything changes.
Everything changes. Talk about a cliffhanger before we get into the details of what happens in their marriage and the diaries. Let's jump into this week's Hollywood Pop Quiz.
And the pop quiz question of the day, of course, deals with the beautiful Mary Astor. Nan mentioned she had a career that spanned decades. The question is, what was Mary Astor's final film performance? And a little clue, it is in a horror cult classic.
Ooh. All right. We will be back with the answer and more on the Mary Astor Diaries after this.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. I also host the number one sleep podcast in the world called Sleep Cove, where millions drift off to meditations, hypnosis, and bedtime stories. We soon realized that listeners wanted to hear our mystery stories all in one place, so we created Mysteries at Midnight, where you can listen to all new tales every week. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes. So why don't you pick a story now? And can you guess the twist?
Steve and Ann will be right back, but first another stop on our Hollywood tour. The name of the first movie star ever was Florence Lawrence, but few people at the time knew it. You see, she was simply known as the Biograph Girl. She was born in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. She grew up in vaudeville, and she came to the U.S. to start acting in this fledgling motion picture industry. Now, by 1908, she was working at Biograph Films, appearing in dozens of short films, or shorts as they were called, directed by pioneer director D.W. Griffith. Fans called her the Biograph Girl because she wasn't credited by name on those shorts. Why? Well, early producers didn't want actors to have the kind of fame that might lead them to demand, say, more money. In 1910, Lawrence switched to Carl Laemmle's Independent Motion Picture Company, also known as IMP, and Laemmle gave her a huge publicity campaign, including finally crediting Lawrence by name. The modern movie star was born, but Lawrence did not go on to the immense riches of successors like, say, Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin. In fact, by the 1930s, she was subsisting on charity bit parts from mogul Louis B. Mayer. And, tragically, in 1938, she took her own life. So even back then, stardom, or the lack of it, could be a very tragic thing. And now, back to Steve and Nan from Beneath the Hollywood Sign.
Welcome back, everyone. Before we get into more details about Mary Astor and her scandalous diaries, we just wanted to give a big shout-out to our listener of the week, and that is Jeffrey Wilson from Kentucky. Jeffrey brought up an interesting point to us early on in our podcast, and we so appreciated it. And we've had this lovely correspondence going back, and I really appreciate all of his listening and all of his support. So thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. All right. When we last were discussing...
<Da-doom>.
So Mary is now married to Dr. Thorpe, but things are not going
well. The honeymoon is over.
And kind of in a nasty way. He's emotionally and verbally abusive, which is horrible.
Horrible.
But he also could be physically abusive as well.
Yeah, because in 1932, they have a daughter together, Marilyn. And the thing that really is troublesome is that after time goes on, Mary suspects that he might be physically abusive to Marilyn.
Right.
This is probably the final straw for Mary, so she asked for divorce in December of 1932, but Franklin cries and begs and says he'll change his ways and begs her not to do it, so she gives in and she stays.
Okay, and then she decides, though, that she's going to get away for
I think they go through another rough patch and she decides to get out of town.
And she has a dear friend in New York. I mean, she's Mary Astor. She probably has a lot of dear friends. And she goes to New York, and this is a pivotal point.
Yes, it is. Because before she gets to New York, she talks to her really good friend, Marion Seltzer, who was a script editor at Paramount. And Marion says, well, if you're going to New York, you've got to meet my friend, George S. Kaufman. Of course...
Which I find so funny because it's like, could I meet your Pulitzer Prize winning friend, George S. Kaufman?
Exactly.
Yes, I'd be happy to.
You know, writer of You Can't Take It With You and Mary We Roll Along and The Man Who Came to Dinner.
With Mosshart.
Maybe I can find time to meet with him.
Oh, my goodness. So she goes to New York and she meets George S. Kaufman.
And it is fire immediately.
Yep.
They are so drawn to each other. It turns into a torrid love affair.
Right. Despite both of them being married. Because George's Kaufman was married as well.
But George had a very open relationship with his wife, which all of New York knew it. So it wasn't such a big deal for him. It was a big deal for Mary.
Right.
Especially when you bring Marilyn into the equation.
Of course. Now, one thing that we kind of haven't set up very well here, Steve, is the fact that Mary has been keeping a diary.
Oh.
Most of her life.
Yes, Mary writes everything down.
And so this torrid affair with George S. Kaufman is chronicled on a daily basis.
In great detail.
In great detail. Okay. So the affair continues. She heads back to Los Angeles, right?
Well, she does. She goes back to Los Angeles. And at this point, she's think she's in love with Kaufman, that she really wants to get out of this marriage so that they can be together.
Right.
So she goes to Thorpe. She asks for a divorce again. I think this is September of 1934.
And he says no.
He says no again. Well, she says no, no to your no. And she takes Marilyn and they move out.
Right.
But Thorpe anticipated all of this. He figured this was going to happen eventually. So months earlier, he had searched their home and found her diaries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he read some pretty horrible things in those diaries, you know, mostly about
himself.
You know, she basically talks about what a failure in the bedroom he was and how she hated his name dropping and his social climbing and that she was furious at how he blew through her hard-earned money.
Right.
One thing when they first got married is he made her set him up in his own private practice as a doctor, which was still kind of struggling. So she was still the breadwinner.
Right.
So she even made fun of him trying to grow a mustache like Clark Gable. So
right.
The diary was not very flattering to Dr. Thorpe.
But it was very flattering to somebody that she named, in quotes, G, which it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that's
yes.
George S. Kaufman.
Yes.
And she goes into, allegedly, great sexual detail about her lover, G, in New York, and how he was her perfect match.
Perfect match, yeah. Yes. He plans to use this diary as collateral to keep Mary in check and so that she doesn't divorce him, that he can control Mary. Well, Mary had had a lifetime of control, and she was not going to have it anymore.
Right.
So she's like, screw it. I don't care. I'm going to continue to see George. I don't care what happens. It got so bad that Dr. Thorpe even paid Kaufman a visit one time when Kaufman was in Los Angeles. He went to his hotel and he basically begged him to stop seeing Mary for the sake of the family and his daughter. Kaufman pretended to agree to stop seeing Mary, even though he had no intention of doing so. Well, this made Mary furious. So it just was just gas on the fire.
Right. But eventually they do decide.
Well, they do. Mary finally says, we are getting divorced.
Yes.
And Thorpe says, fine. The only way we're going to divorce is if I get full custody of Marilyn.
Right.
And if you don't agree to this, I will leak these diary pages to the press. Your reputation will be ruined.
Right.
Your career will be over. You will lose custody of your daughter.
And
you'll be done.
Not only will she be done,
yes.
but Kaufman would probably be done.
Yeah, and apparently Mary wrote about her friend's secrets too.
Right. And so studios
yes,
were actually nervous about what yeah. was in the diaries. So
yeah, there was a rumor that Mary had raided every male star she'd ever slept with. And so all the studios are worried that their big virile male stars are
right.
going to get a bad rating in Mary's diary.
Right. So
it becomes a thing.
She agrees to not have custody of her daughter.
She does. She agrees to give up her daughter's custody
right.
so that she doesn't ruin all these lives.
Right. But a year later, she decides, I can't do this.
Yeah.
After finding bruises on Marilyn, she says, no. I don't care what's going to happen with the diaries. It becomes a huge custody battle that is very public
yeah.
and pretty graphic.
Yeah, very,
and
very
salacious.
Graphic. Yeah, it becomes like the trial of the century. You know, at the time, I think the trial was set for July 29th, 1936. During that time, she's filming Dodsworth
mm-hmm.
for director William Wyler. So she has to stop filming and go to trial. Which, of course, anybody in Hollywood, you know, time is money, so that's not cool with them.
Right.
Thorpe got very vindictive. Before the trial even started, he leaked a few pages to the press.
Right.
That basically paint Mary as this whore, this bad mother. He wants to set the tone for the trial.
Right. And actually, it's a good time to mention that the reason the diaries were known as the Purple Diaries is because people claimed that she wrote in purple ink, which was actually not true.
Yeah, that was brown?
It was brown ink, yeah. But I can see where brown and purple might have a similar hue.
Exactly. Once these diary pages hit the press, this became big news. I mean, it was the sexy, sordid kind of trial, and so everybody was paying attention.
Well, and he was saying, basically, through his attorneys, that she was being accused of gross and immoral conduct.
Yes.
And that she was morally unfit to care for their daughter.
Yeah, which is...
This is big stuff.
Big stuff.
Yeah.
Well, the trial goes on, and during the trial, George S. Kaufman has to come to Los Angeles to work on a Marx Brothers movie.
Yes, right.
Which I find that so interesting that he would ever work on a Marx Brothers movie. He doesn't. Anyway, I digress on that. But so they decide that once he's in town, or that since he's in town, that they want to subpoena him. Mm-hmm. So they track him down, they issue a subpoena, but he's able to skip town with the help of his friend Moss Hart, so he doesn't have to testify in this salacious trial.
And Mary, during this time, is repeatedly maintaining that these excerpts were lurid forgeries.
Yeah, and it was alleged that Thorpe actually made up some of this stuff he released to the press. So, you never knew what really was something she wrote and what was something that was in his imagination that he fabricated.
Right, exactly.
But the trial goes on, and Mary had this incredible attorney, Roland Rich Woolley. He was one of the top attorneys of the time. She had gotten him through actress Anne Harding because he helped her with her divorce case. Well, he was a ringer. I mean, he was such a great attorney. Well, he raked Dr. Thorpe over the coals during the trial.
So, well, because he was seeing women.
Well, I was going to say, Mr. Sanctimonious here.
Yeah, exactly.
He had a myriad of women coming in and out, spending the night.
When Marilyn was there.
While the daughter was there. And then there was a drunken brawl where the cops had to come in and drag this woman out of the house. Well, he brought all of that into the trial. It counterbalanced the immorality of Mary as a parent because he was doing some of the same things that he accused her of.
Right. Exactly.
During the trial, of course, this being Hollywood, they stopped the trial for a week so that Mary could go back and finish her little movie. Because that's what they do in Hollywood.
Right.
So, but when she came back, it was a different Mary.
It was a different Mary. And accounts are that she had this newfound confidence. And she later stated that she stayed in character from her Dodsworth character, from the picture that she was working on, so that she was able to handle, you know how cross-examinations can be. You know how many times we've been in trial, right? And those hard cross-examinations.
Right.
She was able to handle it coolly and calmly and skillfully, which was, of course, going to be to her benefit, and portray her as this not crazy person, not a person who was capable of what her ex-husband was saying she was capable of.
Yeah, which was so smart on her part. If you're an actor, use your skill sets. I mean, if this character is cool and in control and intelligent, use it. And I think she did, and it served her really well, because Thorpe's lawyers, they continue to make the trial about these salacious entries into Mary's diary, and they talk about her life and how immoral she is. Well, finally, the judge had enough. And he said, this is not a trial that's going to reopen the divorce case. This is about the custody of a 4-year-old child.
And, kudos to him.
Yes.
Just as a quick side note, though, because we often paint these studio heads as being awful. Mary Astor was almost fired from Dodsworth following the revelation of the affair with George S. Kaufman. But Samuel Goldwyn insisted that she stay in the picture. And that's also pivotal post-trial to what ends up happening in her career.
Yes.
So as you said, the judge said, no more. This is not reopening the divorce. It is about the custody. Yeah. And I'm going to give you 3 days to figure it out.
Yes.
And they do.
And they did it. They came back with a very fair agreement for the custody. Marilyn would be awarded to her mother during the school months and to her father for vacation periods and weekends. And any teacher or governess or nurse for the child would have to be agreed upon by both parties.
Right.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. So the trial's over. This movie, Dodsworth, is done filming.
The thing that Mary thought after this trial, she figured, my career is over. I'm done.
I'm canceled.
Yes.
The equivalent of canceled back then.
But as you said, Dodsworth came out. It debuted in September of 1936. Mm-hmm. And so when Mary first appears on screen in this movie, audiences across the United States clapped and cheered for her.
which is, you know, pretty remarkable.
I mean, they were on her side.
And
I'm sure nothing like a good scandal to boost a movie.
Exactly. And boost a career.
It boosted her career into the stratosphere.
Yeah, exactly. Because some of her best work happens after this.
Oh, I think most of her best work happens after this.
Yeah. All right. So now everybody's probably wondering, what happened to the diary?
Yes. Where's the diary?
So the judge orders that the diary be locked away, and it was until 1952. So copies were, at that point, removed in 1952. I'm assuming there was some sort of court order that said it must remain locked up for this period of time. And in 1952, the diary was removed, and any copies, because I'm sure there were copies.
Oh, you know there were.
It was removed from the bank vault where it had sat for 16 years, and with a judge standing by, along with Mary and Dr. Thorpe, the pages were set aflame and turned to ashes.
And that's what happened to the diary.
You know, the other thing about Mary Astor that I'm sure if you read her autobiography, it comes into play. She went through a lot of other significant moments in her life. She suffered from alcoholism for 20 years. She checked herself into a sanitarium for alcoholics in 1949. And following a suicide attempt in 1951, she converted to Roman Catholicism.
Yes, yes. If you haven't read her autobiography, if you're into autobiographies at all, this is the one to read. I was telling Nan earlier, it's so well written. It's written with such astute clarity, like no other autobiography I've ever read from a celebrity. So check it out. I think it's called Mary Astor, My Life.
I think it's time for the answer to this week's pop quiz.
And before that, it's probably time for all of you to burn those diaries.
I'm doing it right after we finish recording.
Yes. And of course, the question was, what was Mary Astor's final screen performance? And it was in the cult classic Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
Of course.
Where she plays Jewel Mayhew, the woman who basically holds the key to everything. And she's so good. It's a small part, but such a pivotal role. And what a perfect way for someone like Mary Astor to end her career.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 109 films, Mary Astor turned in her SAG card and quietly retired.
And she passed away at the age of 81 in 1987 at the Motion Picture Home out in Woodland Hills.
Yes.
Well, thanks for joining us, everyone, on this conversation about Mary Astor's diaries. We would love it if you would join us on social media, follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can watch the show. Our handle is @FromBeneathTheHollywoodSign.
You can email us at info@FromBeneathTheHollywoodSign.com.
That's this week's View.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign.
You've been listening to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign with Steve Kubine and Nan McNamara, the podcast that celebrates amazing stories of Tinseltown from its golden era. Join us next week for another episode and learn something else about Hollywood you probably never knew. Take a moment and give us a 5-star rating and a positive review. And tell your friends about us too. It'll help grow the podcast. Visit Steve's website at FromBeneathTheHollywoodSign.com. The executive producers are Steve Kubine and Nan McNamara. Executive producer and post-production supervisor, Lindsay Schnebley. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to their other fine shows like The Box of Oddities and The Shallow End with Schnebley and Toth. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved. That's a wrap.